session number 24897, reel 11. General Holm, Reel 11.
You mentioned that you were responsible for the Trucial Oman Scouts. What was the organisation of the Trucial Oman Scouts and their strength and their general character?
Well, the first thing to say, really, about the Trucial Oman Scouts is that they were basically a Foreign Office force under the political resident of the Persian Gulf, who was the boss in the Persian Gulf. But he left the day-to-day running of the scouts to me. Although if there was any tremendous policy matter, he used to get drawn into it. The Trucial Oman Scouts had their headquarters at Sharjah, and they had, you know, I can't quite remember, four or five squadrons, they were called, deployed from Abu Dhabi in the east to I forget the names, Rasselheimer and one or two other states in the west, and at Bahraini as well. Bahraini, having been, before my time, having been the subject of an altercation between the Trucial Oman Scouts and the Sultan's armed forces.
The Sultan of
Oman.
Of Oman.
Oman. I think there was something to do with claiming parts of it. But they'd had a bit of a spat, but that was some time before I arrived, and that was all quiet. What was interesting was that, well, it was a big force, the Trucial Oman Scouts. I mean, I should think well over 1,000. I suppose a squadron was 250 odd.
What was the internal organisation of a squadron? What sort of armament would it have?
Basically small arms, I think basically small arms. I can't really remember now.
Do you remember if they had support weapons?
No, I don't really. I don't.
Basic, you know, 2 or 3 inch mortars or...
I should think, but I can't honestly remember now. We had, in addition, of course, in Sharjah, an armoured car squadron, British armoured car squadron, in support, really, of the Trucial Oman Scouts. Well, interesting, during my time in the Gulf, oil was found in Abu Dhabi.
Oh.
And we provided an officer from the Trucial Oman Scouts to help the ruler of Abu Dhabi really build up an independent army, because he had the money, and he was then going to have his own force. And of course, from that, oil then was found in Dubai and elsewhere. And I imagine that the Trucial Oman Scouts no longer exist in any form. I think they're all, are they all state? I don't know.
What sort of force did the ruler of Abu Dhabi want? Did he have any idea about the scale and strength and armament? Or?
Well, this major, a Major Wilson, who was a squadron commander of the Trucial Oman Scouts, he was detached to advise the Sultan. And he had some pretty big ideas. I mean, helicopters and all sorts, you see. And money, no object. And exactly what the organisation became, I don't know, because this was just in its infancy when I left.
Did the political resident get drawn into that business about the Abu Dhabi force?
Well, I think he did, to the extent that he had to approve what was going on, and he had to approve the fact that we had sent an officer from the Trucial Oman Scouts to help.
Do you remember if he had a view about whether or not it should be a big force with helicopters or not?
I think it was left rather rather to the state. I think the time I was there, I say it was very much in its infancy, and I don't think I certainly by the time I left, it hadn't really got off the ground.
How was a squadron of the Trouche Le Mans Scouts organised internally? Was it broken up into troops?
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
What sort of scale would a troop be? Would these be company size or smaller?
Well, the squadron was really the company size, wasn't it?
About 200, you were saying.
Yeah, I would think of 200 in the squadron. And they must have been organised into either platoons or troops of 30, 40, 50. 50.
So, yes, if it was 50, you'd have scope for four, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you would. Yeah.
So it's quite large in terms of numbers.
I think they were quite big.
Where were they recruited?
Well, some of them recruited from Dhofar in the Oman, because there was one particular squadron commander called Ken Wilson who loved his Dhofaris. And I can remember he had a Dhofari squadron. I suspect the rest of them were recruited from the Trouche Le Mans Scouts itself. Mm. And you see, how many Trouche states were there? Seven? Six or seven?
About seven, I think.
Yeah, I think seven. Mm. Yeah. I don't think there was any shortage of recruits. Mind you, they were British officers, of course. Mm. And there must have been some British NCOs, too, to help with the transport and stuff at that stage.
Specialists?
Yeah.
Where did they do their training? And what sort of training did they do?
In the desert. I mean,
in Oman itself?
Yes. In the Trouche States.
In Trouche States.
Yes. Because the Sultan's Armed Forces in Oman, of course, was quite separate. Mm. We had, in the Oman, we had contract officers. Well, I say we had, the Sultan had contract British officers, and we had seconded officers as well.
Were you responsible for any of them?
Well, I got drawn in only insofar as the seconded officers were concerned, in that I had their confidential reports had to come through me. So that gave me an opportunity to visit them. And they were very kind to me, and I got to know the contract officers well. I met the Sultan once or twice, you know.
What impression did you get of the Sultan?
Well, he was. When I say I met him, this was later on, because when I was there, the old Sultan was in Salalah and never came out of Salalah, and I never met him.
So you're talking about new Sultan,
the
young Sultan.
I met him once.
Yes.
After I'd left, actually, and visited, and he was then installed in Muscat. And he was a very personable young man, Sandhurst trained, wasn't he? Yeah.
He was indeed.
Yes.
Do you know what sort of training course the Omani recruits went through?
No, I can't know.
When they joined up?
No.
How long did they serve? Were they a long service?
Couldn't tell you. I really don't know.
What was their role? What was their purpose?
I suppose defence of the Sultanate, really. Mm. They had nobody, as far as I know, down in Dhofar, where the Sultan lived. But they were deployed in northern Oman. Muscat was their headquarters, or just outside Muscat. And I can remember they had a squadron headquarters at Nizwa and one at Ibri, and one or two other places, and they were deployed fairly wide. And internal security they were responsible for.
Were there any insurgency threats in the area active at the time, in Muscat and Oman or in the Trouche States?
Not when I was there, as far as I remember.
Where did you get your intelligence assessment from about internal security threats and potential threats?
Well, we had quite a good liaison with the Sultan's headquarters, I mean the Sultan's Armed Forces headquarters.
Yes.
And when I went there, for instance, I used to get a very good briefing from the G2 intelligence and other people, for sake of good relations. Mm. And then also in Muscat, I mean in the Trouche Le Mans States. Mm. And we ran once a joint exercise in the Sultan's in the southern of Oman for the joint forces of our parachute battalions and the southern armed forces.
Do you remember what the scenario was? No. That exercise or
not really? No.
How was it controlled? Were you in direct control of it, or did you have a?
It was run by under the command of the Sultan Armed Forces Commander, who was a full colonel, really, of ours. Mm. Yeah.
What sort of staff did you have to assist you in dealing with all your responsibilities? Because you had a wide range, didn't you?
Well, I did and I didn't, because, you see, we had this parachute battalion and administrative lot in Bahrain who were directly under me. We had a thing in Kuwait called the Kuwait Liaison Team, who were quite a small thing, but they had a stockpile of tanks. Mm. And I had a watching brief on them, but they were basically under the Kuwaitis. We had the True Sulaiman Scouts, who I was really responsible for their day-to-day affairs, but overall responsibility rested with the political residents. And in the Oman, the Sultan's armed forces were really independent, but we kept very close liaison with them. And as I say, we had these seconded officers for whom I had some responsibility.
Did you have any incidents in the area while you were in command?
Not that I can remember. Nothing serious. No.
So was it then mainly a matter of routine training and administration?
Yes. And there were various things happening all the time. Our parachute battalion from Bahrain at one stage went down to the Radfan because they were needed down there. And the political residents said, that's all right. So we sent them down there. I think we had some of them back quite soon in case something had blown up. I forget what it was.
Did you ever find that the rather complicated interaction between the military authorities and local civil authorities and the Foreign Office representatives ever caused any friction or difficulty?
No. We had the political resident, Persian Gulf, was a fellow called Sir William Luce, who was a very senior ambassador, really, who'd spent a lot of his life in the Sudan and then had come up to Bahrain. And he was a splendid chap. And everybody, you know, he set the tone.
Did you have daily meetings with him?
No. Once a week, I think. I think basically once a week.
Were they conducted on a formal basis?
No, very informal. Pretty informal. Mm. There was his staff, or representative of his staff, and our three service commanders, Air Force, Navy, and Army. And we had a very good relationship.
You never had to have an emergency meeting?
I think we did once. I think there was a problem down at RAF Salalah. Whether it was the forerunner of the Dhofar campaign, you know, they had a different, but this was a good many years before. But we did send a platoon from the parachute regiment down to RAF Salalah for local protection at one time, because the RAF, there was a bit of a problem there.
What were the RAF doing in Salalah? Were they?
Well, it was an RAF station. You see, they had an RAF station at Salalah, one at Mazira, one at Maharik, which was in Bahrain, and one at Aden. There were the four RAF stations.
And what was their mission, the RAF contingent in the area? What were they doing?
Well, the one at Salalah was the staging post between Aden and Bahrain, because a lot of the aircraft were Beverleys and Arguses and things, and they couldn't do the whole trip. Mazira, I suppose, was a relic of the imperial age. But the Sultan enjoyed having them, I think. You know, I think he liked them there.
Did you have much contact with the rulers of the states?
And I didn't, not a great deal. I used to visit them sometimes. If I visited the Jerusalem Lemon Scouts, I would sometimes have to go and attend a feast, you know, a fuddle. But purely for liaison purposes, really.
What was life like for you in Bahrain, in terms of living accommodation, recreation, things like that?
Well, living accommodation was very good. We were a very small British community, apart from the three services. I don't know how many Brits there were in Bahrain, not more than about a dozen, I think. And, you know, Shell and those sort of people. And the banks. And we made our own fun. And when we found in our life that when you make your own fun, it's much more enjoyable than, you know, when everything is rather more sophisticated.
Tailor-made for your own purposes.
But we had a very enjoyable posting. Very hot in the summer. But we were lucky because we were in the days of air conditioning. And we used to hear terrible stories about pre-air conditioning days in the summer. But, no, it was good value. And, of course, you get a winter in Bahrain, which is the great salvation, really.
Did you have occasion to go up to Kuwait?
Yes, I used to go to Kuwait. I used to go, I don't know how often, once a quarter, perhaps, perhaps more.
And I think in 1961 we'd had a deployment to Kuwait to...
Correct, but that was before...
You arrived there.
I arrived.
Was there anything going on there during in your time as a sort of hangover from that?
Well, only I suspect perhaps the Kuwait liaison team was left behind with a stockpile of tanks, not many tanks, but just as a deterrent.
Was it considered then that there was still potentially a threat from Iraq to Kuwait?
I think, you know, dormant. I think.
Dormant.
Yeah, dormant.
Yeah. What about the relations with the Saudis? Because from time to time there have been frontier difficulties, haven't there, around the Saudi realm?
They never came my way, the Saudis. Because Bahrain was then still an island.
Yes.
And now, of course, it's got a bridge, hasn't it, and all that. Yeah.
What happened then at the end of your time in the Persian Gulf?
I went and became Chief of Staff at Western Command.
What did that entail doing? What was the duty?
Nothing very much.
Nothing very much. What was in Western Command?
Well, not much. There were a few static units. TA, there was a tank training place at Castle Martin. It was in the day, I mean, it was the rundown of the old static command structure. And nobody had quite got round, the time I was there, to abolishing it, which they did in the end. And it became, of course, the strategic headquarters at Salisbury, Wilton, and then district headquarters in various other places, like Shrewsbury and York. This, that, and the other. Western Command, in fact, was abolished.
So they were cutting out a layer of the command chain.
They were.
Do you think that was a justified move?
Absolutely. I do. Because, I mean, I shouldn't say we were completely idle, but, I mean, there wasn't a great deal for us to do. And we had a foot and mouth epidemic when I was there. So, you know, our command headquarters was able to help with that.
Who actually told you what to do during the foot-and-mouth epidemic? Was that... Did that come down through the Ministry of Defence?
Came from the Ministry of Defence, yes.
So it didn't have direct liaison with the Minister of Agriculture?
Not that I remember, but I suppose we did on the ground. But we didn't at our headquarters.
What sort of help were you able to give?
Rather like the last one, I think. Disposing of carcasses, organisation, you know, I mean... setting up a command structure.
And your static units were able to...
Yes. And we had one or two regular units based in the command.
What were the static units doing? Were they mainly training?
Yes, signals.
Schools.
You know, yes. I say, this Castle Martin tank training place.
Was that still being used by the German army at that time?
It was.
How did you get on with them?
Well, I didn't get on with them. I mean, I used to visit the Castle Martin, but They were an MOD training area, really.
Mm.
And I know, certainly never met any Germans, but as far as I know, it went all right. I think they quite enjoyed it.
Should have asked you before about the, before we finished with dealing with your time in the Gulf, did you have contingency plans for major incidents or difficulties arising in your area of responsibility? For example, a renewed Iraqi threat to Kuwait or something of that sort?
Not that I remember.
You didn't have any major reinforcement outline plans?
No. Interesting, in the 1961, before I got there, the political resident told me once that he was a man who had insisted on the reinforcement of Kuwait against all the advice of our ambassador in Kuwait, who wanted to play it cool.
So this was loose, was it?
It was loose.
Saying we needed to put something
in
there.
He was the man who said, look, I am going to do this. Because he was the commander-in-chief of the Gulf, as well as being political resident.
Mm.
And it was quite an interesting... I think it was all right. I mean, we all got on very well together. But my commander-in-chief was in Aden.
Mm.
But I was also responsible to the commander-in-chief of the Gulf. And there was a sort of dual responsibility.
Division.
Yeah. Mm. But, I mean, it all worked all right.
Well, I think that kind of thing always does work all right, as long as the personalities involved get on with each other. But when they don't...
That's right.
You can be in serious trouble.
Yeah.
Who was commanding in Aden then at that time?
General Harrington, Charles Harrington. And then he left... Oh. Yes, he did leave while I was there, and an admiral came. Yeah.
You mentioned how events in Aden at one time did have an impact on your area.
Yeah, because the parachute battalion went down
Yes. Were there other occasions when you were on warning, as it were, for possible ructions in Aden causing...
No, they were the only force we had which could go down there.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Well, they're strategically placed, aren't they? They're also within range, are they not, of East Africa, if there should happen to be a need for deployment there.
Yes, there was never any suggestion that they should go to East Africa.
Mm.
Yeah.
So you had a couple of years at headquarters, Western Command.
I had, about 15 months.
15 months.
15 months only.
And then I think your next move, you were a divisional brigadier.
I was.
Queen's Division. Now, what does that mean? What is the what is the role of the divisional
brigadier?
When
I was appointed, nobody had the foggiest idea.
I see.
Of what we were meant to be doing. These infantry divisions had just been formed.
Yeah.
The object was to save overheads, basically, in that you would have one divisional depot and one training depot in place of regimental depots.
Yes.
It was all part of the streamlining process. I had my headquarters in Colchester, and to start with, I think I had just one G2 there, and we eventually built it up a little bit. We had in our division the Royal Anglian Regiment, the Fusiliers, and the Queen's Regiment. And it was quite a tricky thing to set up, because colonels of regiments didn't want their wings clipped in any way by divisional headquarters. And sometimes the most furious arguments would go on.
What sort of things would give rise to such arguments?
Well, you see, by its nature, the divisional system was meant to streamline, in a way, the regimental system. And I can remember one edict coming out, I think it was a throwaway line, saying that, of course, there would have to be a divisional cap badge. Well, that caused the most tremendous ructions amongst the colonels, and it was dropped, that idea.
Do you remember who came up with this idea?
I don't know. They came out of the...
Or what the cap badge was supposed to be like.
No, we had to design that.
You had to design that?
But it was a very short-lived thing.
Mm.
And we had the most amazing meetings. We had a colonel commandant.
Mm-hmm.
colonel commandant of the division.
And who was that?
He was a fellow called Michael Forrester.
Oh, yes, Queen's man.
That's right. Mm. And he was, of course, junior in rank to all these colonels of regiments who were mostly retired.
And very senior officers, I suppose.
Very senior officers. And I used to go to these meetings with him, just me, and arguments used to bandy to and fro. And we had to tread quite carefully, really. Mm.
Did you find that you came into conflict with the Colonel Commandant, or were you normally naturally aligned?
No, I didn't come into contact with him. I knew him quite well, actually.
Yes, you didn't come into conflict with him.
No. I think he had a pretty difficult time at one time. Because anything he suggested was usually shot down in flames, you know.
Would that be done automatically as a sort of conditioned response by the
very jealous, you see, of their independence. But in fact, like a lot of these things, the thing settled down in the end. I mean, after my day, the thing settled down.
Now, was this division intended to be an operational division?
No, it's purely administrative. Yes, purely administrative. And I'm not sure how it's evolved, really, now. I think we had a little staff at Bassingbourne, was our depot, RAF station at Bassingbourne. The recruits were all trained, you see, from the division.
For all three regiments you've mentioned.
Yeah, that was a sort of plus, I suppose, and it cut out a lot of overheads.
Were they trained by a divisional training team or by regimental training teams posted into the depot?
I think you tried to keep it within the regiment, in other words. You've got regimental recruits with their own instructor. But, of course, all that is now finished because they have... I don't know what they have, basic training centres or something?
Yes, infantry training
centres.
I think the cap badge is not confirmed until they've done their basic.
Isn't it? No.
Not certain about
you
that.
You see, I was retired 30 years ago, so a lot has moved on.
Did it have any impact on the soldiers, do you think, as opposed to the colonel's commandant and the...
Not a great deal, I don't suppose. Not a great deal. I used to go around to a lot of training places, and I must say that the recruits were very keen to keep their own regimental thing. They'd joined up, you see, in the Royal Regiment of Fusiliers.
Yes.
And they didn't want anybody mucking about with it, really. At one time, when it first started, and I don't know how much this goes on now, there was a common promotion system for RSM, sergeant majors, sergeants, and I have a feeling corporals. But how far that got, I'm not sure.
Would that have involved cross-posting?
Yeah, it did, to start with. But I have a feeling that sort of got overtaken by events. I'm not sure.
That might have been very unpopular, mightn't it?
Yes,
corporals have been moved.
Yeah, in theory, it was quite a good idea, because it gave a prospective RSM more scope, rather than within his own regiment.
Certainly bring more flexibility.
Yeah, that's right. But I don't know if that lasted or not.
Well, rebadging has always been a very tricky matter, hasn't it?
Has.
It
has.
Soldiers. What sort of facilities did you have for training within the division?
Well, I didn't have any, because I was at little administrative headquarters in Colchester. I never really got mixed up in the training.
Where did they go? Did they come into Colchester to do their basic, or did they go to
all at Bassingbourne. And I suspect they used to go. I mean, there's a big training area at Stamford
that's Stamford Norfolk. As well.
What I mean.
Yes.
I don't know.
Did it settle down while you were there as divisional brigadier, or was it still bubbling away?
Yeah, I think my successor was a fellow called Adrian Wise. He was a fusilier. And the colonel of the fusiliers was a fellow called Ken Darling, who was then CNC of that Northern NATO command in Oslo.
F North.
That's right. And he told me once, he said,